Shamit Dua joins me to discuss the New Orleans Pelicans, including the one day off that Herb Jones takes every year, Zion Williamson's roller coaster ride thus far, and fighting giraffes and raccoons. All that and more is coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. Well, I keep returning in my mind to the glass onion, something that seems densely layered, mysterious, and inscrutable, but in fact, the center is in plain sight. And that's why this case has confounded me like no other, why every complex layer peeled back has revealed another layer and another layer and come to naught. And that was the problem right there. You see, I expected complexity. I expected intelligence. I expected a puzzle, a game. But that's not what any of this is. It hides not behind complexity, but behind mind-numbing, obvious clarity. It doesn't hide at all. I was staring right at it. John Gennaro, count me in!
One, two, three.
Today's first words belong to Benoit Blanc from the 2022 film Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things that I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and talk about it into this microphone and into that camera. Pretty good deal. Number two, avoiding serious injury while ice skating. I'm not much of a skater, but I played a little bit of hockey when I was younger, and I took our daughters to the Prospect Park ice skating rink this weekend in Brooklyn. It was great, had a lot of fun, except for the time when I went to go take a little lap on my own and instantly ate it. Like, just fucking ate dove went right down, like on my shoulder first and then straight out on my belly like I was sliding into home. Thankfully, 2 days later, I can say that I hurt nothing but my pride. And the good news about that is I didn't have all that much of that to begin with. Number three, as important as not hurting yourself severely, I get to spend part of my morning talking with someone whose work I enjoy very much. My guest today is a writer, talker, thinker, and bon vivant, whose work I'm pretty sure I first encountered at the blog Bourbon Street Shots when it was part of the True Hoop Network, ESPN, covering the New Orleans Pelicans. These days, you can find him writing and talking about those same Pelicans over on Substack at In The Know, like in the N-O, like New Orleans. Get it? All right, you're on board. Or over on Twitter at Fear The Brown. Friends, a warm welcome for Shamit Dua. Shamit, thank you so much for making some time for us. How are you doing today?
Dan, I'm doing fantastic. No better way to start off a morning than this. So I'm super excited.
We got to find you a better way to start off your morning. Like, first off, up top, we got to like make sure we're cranking up the positivity for you, even above what I just provided there. Although I guess it's good to find out that someone else got hurt and not you. That's always a nice way to start.
I guess. I mean, like, I don't know if I like take joy in other people getting hurt either, but sure. Yeah, it wasn't me.
That's true, right? As long as, and then all, now we're thinking about Shaggy, so we're on a really good vibe all the way. It was moving forward into it. I've asked you here today, Shamit, because last week on No Cap Room, I was talking with Patrick Redford of Defector, and we were highlighting teams we wanted to keep an eye on down the stretch, teams we were particularly interested in, and we talked a bunch about the Pelicans, and then they promptly blew the doors off the Rockets, turned in one of their worst offensive performances of the season, had Najee Marshall fight Jimmy Butler, which feels like an intercontinental title match, had Jose Alvarado fight Thomas Bryant, which feels like the kind of no weight classes UFC fights they had back in the day, like the early tournaments. And then, because of suspensions and injuries, played with like no ball handlers besides Point Zion and got beat by the Bulls. This would be a weird week for a lot of teams, and yet it kind of feels like par for the course for the Pelicans, a team that is, you know, frequently weird in a lot of directions, and that I often find myself staring at, like my man Benoit Blanc's Glass Onion. Is this team like a majestic piece of art that I can't kind of get my head around? Or is it a team where when you look at it and you get to the heart of it, there's nothing there? I don't know, but they compel me. Again, shouts out to Benoit Blanc. And I find them confusing. So I was hoping that you could help me understand them better, or failing that, help me understand the emotional attachment I've developed to them. That's a big job. Do you feel ready for it?
I can certainly attempt to. You know, I'm sure both of us are going to discover things about this team and each other along the way, but I'm here for the ride.
That's exactly what we're looking for. If nothing else, this is a journey of exploration on Divine Intervention. So I'm glad that we can do that together. And we are going to get into that. But first, here on Divine Intervention, another thing that we do is always try to operate from a place of joy. So, Shamit, what is something from the world of basketball that has brought you joy this week?
So this is super niche, but every single year down here in New Orleans, the Tulane Law School hosts a pro basketball negotiation competition. I see that moment.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, that sounds familiar. And I think maybe my man Jake Fisher was there.
Your man Jake Fisher was there. And we're getting to that part. So they host a pro basketball negotiation competition. And just to kind of sum it up, basically all of really, really good law schools, maybe the best law schools from around the country. I'm not really sure the selection process. They come down to New Orleans. They compete in a 2-day-long competition. Also get to enjoy the city. The competition is based around knowledge of the CBA, and they're given very much real-life prompts. So, for example, one of the prompts was negotiating the Jonathan Kuminga extension with Golden State. And so they have to demonstrate one side represents the team side, one side represents the player side, and both sides have to demonstrate a knowledge of the CBA and also affinity for negotiation. And the competition has grown quite a bit, and they fly in a lot of judges. And so the judges are mostly, salary cap executives, a few assistant general managers, and there was a GM this year, and a lot of agents.
Wow.
And so it's grown, it's become quite like an underrated event, like what I think like Sloan used to be when it first got off the ground a little bit. I think there's a lot less pretense right now than there is in Sloan. I was fortunate to be a judge for that competition. I have been for a few years. Your man Jake Fisher has been as well. And one thing they do really well is after the competition is over, you know, they take you out in New Orleans. They treat you to great New Orleanian food. And then, you know, afterwards, we spend the night out. And I can say, you know, confidently, one of those nights, you know, I was out with Jake and a few others, and we ended up in some very, very interesting places that me as a New Orleanian local just hasn't even been to. So that week brought me a lot of joy. That competition brings me a lot of joy, and I'm fortunate to be a part of it.
Okay, that's great. That's wonderful. I love that you're glad to be a part of it, and I love that you speak positively of the experience and of the competition and of the Tulane environment. Offline, I'm going to need to ask some questions about being out with Jake like that, because I need to have some things to hold over him. Also, this is Jake yet again finding like a creative way to get on Divine Intervention. He's not actually on the show. He's not on the guest list. We have not let him through the velvet ropes, and yet here he is finding a way again. Also, when you were like, yeah, it's a ton of agents and some executives and GMs, I'm like, of course this freaking guy was down there. This is like, it's like a target rich environment for a guy such as Jake Fisher. But that is wonderful. I'm glad that you guys got to connect, and I'm glad he didn't embarrass himself too bad that he can't come back on our show on Thursday. So that's good to know.
He's omnipresent. He's everywhere.
That's what I'm saying. He'll be back in Brooklyn and connecting with me no time. That's very good. And we're going to stay in New Orleans, obviously. And we're going to keep operating from a place of joy, because I want to start our conversation about the Pelicans with me feeding you the rock. We're going to go 1-4 flat. If you want to call me up for like a snug pick and roll at the elbow so you can get to your left, Zion working at the point, I'll leave that up to you. But I want to give you the chance to wax rhapsodic about somebody on the Pelicans who doesn't get enough love from people like me. Everybody talks about Zion. People talk, Brandon Ingram's been an all-star. Who is someone on the Pelicans that you want to celebrate? Because Divine Intervention is, if nothing else, a celebration.
So I think Herb Jones needs to be the guy here. Herb Jones is, in my opinion, a foundational pillar of this team, right? They drafted him 35th overall, hoping that, hey, he can, maybe be a role player. Year one, he's thrown into a fire as a starting stopper, like a defensive stopper. Willie Green kind of makes the call. You know, there was rumors about him at training camp. That's where he got his nickname, not on Herb, that he's just this fantastic defender. Willie Green, there was a couple injuries to start the season that first year. Willie Green's like, I'm starting Herb Jones. And people are like, cool, let's do it. And since then, this guy has tirelessly worked to the point where he takes one day off in the offseason to go fish. And he'll tell you, he loves fishing and he just hasn't had much success. But, he's not only become one of the league's premier defenders, but he's like become a well-rounded offensive player. So like typically players of his prototype, teams are happy to sort of sag off of him, let the, you know, Pelicans try to play through him, increase his usage, be like, okay, as long as it's not Brandon or Zion taking the shots, it's Herb Jones taking the shots, we'll live, right? You can't live with ramping up Herb Jones's usage. He's become that good. And I think, you know, he's taken, in my opinion, he's taken that as like a sign of disrespect. Okay, you're not going to guard me. I'm just going to make you suffer. And he's done that time in, time out again. And, you know, like not to get into the calculus of things, like for the last 2 months, you know, since the new year, he's also been the Pelicans like net rating leader, barring, you know, some garbage time Cody Zeller minutes, which we won't count those. But like he's just been so incredibly important to this team, and everyone knows how good of a defensive player he is. I'm just not sure people have caught on to how good he's become offensively, particularly off the ball. He's shooting around 41% from three, a little bit low volume, but he's playing a very complete game. So he's being used as a screener. His like usage in screening actions has increased. He's finishing with his offhand at such a high clip. I think one of the biggest improvements he's made this year is just finishing overall. He came into the league in summer league just like whiffing layups. He just would leave him short at the rim, and now he's become a very high level finisher for his position. And just and when you need him to play make, especially in short roll situations, like he's very, very good at reading the floor. And so I think Herb Jones needs all the love and all the credit, and that guy, this team would be nowhere without him.
I love that for a lot of reasons. One, because I love the idea of going from not on Herb to not off Herb. Like, you can't sag off Herb anymore. Like, you got to make sure you're up to touch, that you're contesting that for real. But then also, as you said, it's like you're building an offensive game bit by bit over time. It's what can you do right away? All right, park you in the corner. Maybe you beat a closeout and then make the next pass. But now it's like he is a bullet in transition too. Like, he gets the ball on the wing, he's right to the rim, and he's finishing it through contact. He's finishing confidently. And yeah, when you are a non-shooter, how do we use you on offense? How do we make sure we can still keep you on the floor with your defense? Well, all right, set some screens and roll, like be a short roll, you know, playmaker. And he had to kind of build his game brick by brick, bit by bit. Or maybe brick is the right word for it. But he had to build his game bit by bit to get to a place where Willie Green can feel confident enough in kind of whatever lineup constructions you need that you can have him out there. And as a result of that, like he becomes that rising tide that lifts all boats. So yeah, I love that. Like Herb, I have not started to do any. I do have a ballot, or I had a ballot until we'll find out if they take it away from me. I think I still have a ballot. If I do, in fact, have a ballot, I would have a very hard time not including Herb Jones on an all defense team, because he has been like, he is everywhere on everybody of every shape, size, and stripe for that team, for a team that continues to have a top 10 defense year, like despite all these young guys and despite all these guys that you shouldn't be able to build a defense around. A big reason for that is Herb Jones. So absolutely firmly agree. And more to the point, I love that it's like, it's not just what we know about that guy, what we already knew. It's about what he's been doing, you know, sort of under the cover to make all that play up. So it's a show that where we can appreciate improvement, we can appreciate the elevation, and Herb Jones certainly deserves that. Now that we've done that, Shimmett, we do need to talk a little bit about the table setting that, you know, around the Pelicans here, and just sort of try to set it all up. They're about to hit the road for a back-to-back against the Knicks and Pacers, or they are on the road, rather. They'll start that tonight. We're recording on Tuesday morning. Enter the week at 34-24, right there with the Suns in the 5 and 6 spots in the West, a half game up on the Kings and Mavericks in that cluster right below the home court advantage spots. They're 8th in net rating for cleaning the glass, 14th on offense, 7th on defense, as we mentioned. Both of that is kind of dragged down a little bit by the beginning of the season, where they had a lot of guys in and out with injury. You had no Jose Alvarado for a long time. You had no Trey Murphy for a long time. Larry Nance out. Since their loss to the Lakers in the in-season tournament semifinals, 22-13, 11th on offense, 3rd on defense, like firmly contender tier metrics. This is, by most measurements, a pretty to very good team. And yet, I think that there's probably a lot of people that have some trepidation about buying that. Like, the vibe surrounding them feels a little more stressed than those numbers might indicate. So I think they can win a playoff series, and maybe, you know, depending on how matchups go, maybe even more than that. But is that nuts? Is that like underselling them? Like what are they? How do we feel about this team?
Great question. One that many around here have tried to figure out and articulate. I'm sure the team is trying to answer the same question.
Sure.
So let me start from your last question, and we'll kind of work backwards here. You know, should we? You know, you talk about like them potentially winning a round. Should we be worrying about them as something more? And I think first and foremost, this is a team that hasn't proven anything yet. So like, I think they have to earn that benefit of the doubt. And right. I think a lot of the hesitation behind kind of like crowning this as like the next team up is stemming from the fact that they haven't proven anything, right? So they've only made the playoffs once in the Brandon Ingram Zion tenure, right? They've been a play-in team a few times now. They only first recorded a winning record this past year, and they didn't even make the playoffs then. So like, there are still steps to go before they kind of enter this echelon of contenders. But I do think in the West, there are certain teams that they match up favorably against. You know, Sacramento is one of them. Minnesota, they've had a pretty good time against. OKC, they've had the type of defenders that you can throw on Shea. And so, you know, those are teams that you're like, okay, if things break right, they can maybe get to the next round. And then it just kind of becomes, in my opinion, a little bit of a game of attrition, but also a lot of bit a game of who your best stars are. And I think the stars are the driving conversation behind the New Orleans Pelicans and maybe kind of like creating this feeling of uncertainty for those observing them. So just to kind of set the stage here, this is Zion Williamson and Brandon Ingram's healthiest year together by far. And they frankly have never made it to this stage of the season and still be vying for a playoff spot, much less, you know, like a spot where they can just outright avoid the play-in, right? That's kind of the stakes here. They have been less than fantastic. You know, in my opinion, they are a duo very capable of individual greatness. They have not yet figured out how to maximize each other. And so I think there's some change being left on the table there. Or maybe it's just, maybe there isn't change there. And that's the reality, is like they can't maximize each other. And so that's something they're going to have to discover in the postseason. It's a little bit different when you're winning games because 3 through 11 on your roster are just very good, very cohesive. They are playing their roles to a T. They're playing up in roles when guys are missing. You know, like a role player star show. That's what it is. Like, those guys are stars in their role. I don't know if I've worded that correctly, but it's been a role player show, right? When they've needed stuff out of Jonas Valanciunas, he's given it to him consistently. CJ McCollum has transformed his shot profile to become that of one where he's taking either three or paint shots almost exclusively. He's cut out the long two. He's having his most efficient year to date because of his shot profile transformation. And frankly, they've just not been able to win that many games without him. They've survived games where Zion misses, or they've survived games where Brandon misses, but CJ misses, they can't seem to figure it out. There's just a necessary blend of shooting, ball handling, creation that he brings. And I assume there's a little bit of that leadership too, right? That matters on the floor. But so the stars, you know, even at their best, I feel like they've been borderline top 25 players. But on balance, it's been like, you know, I'm just throwing out numbers to you. These are estimates. There's no science behind this. Sure. But like, you know, at their best, I feel like, you know, for the last 2 months or so, Zion's been quite good, actually. It's just, I'm sure we'll get into the Zion specifically. But like, you know, I would say he's been like the 32nd best player. And then like Brandon Ingram has been like the 43rd best player in the league. And like, right. You can only do so much when those are your two best players. And those are problems that show up in the playoffs. And now if those guys trend towards being top 15 and top 25 by the time the playoffs arrives, or that's the level that they're performing at, it's a very different conversation than what it is now. Because you get to the postseason and you're going up against KD, Booker, and Beal. You're going up against Jokic and Jamal. You're going up against Luka. You're going up against Kawhi, Paul George, James Harden. All of these guys who, you know, if they're going to be playing 38 to 43 minutes a game. And so, like, Jose Alvarado has been great, but like, I don't know if I right. like love him against James Harden, you know, like, I don't know if I love him against a Luka Doncic for even in bursts. And so like, the stars are going to have to take their game up a notch, and that'll ultimately define the ceiling of what's been a very, very good team.
Oh, a bunch in there that I want to riff off of or talk about. One thing is that it makes me think of one of my favorite, I've mentioned it on this show, I think, in No Cap Room 2, one of my favorite tweets and observations of all time, which was Miles Brown talking about the Knicks a couple of years ago in the Hawks series, when he called Julius Randle Canal Street Zion and said the problems show up in the playoffs because everybody else's bag is real. And which makes me think of real Zion. And of you also, you're saying, like, when you go up against these teams, you're going up against legit all NBA guys up and down every roster. And that is what Zion has shown he can be. And it's why I think a lot of this season has left you feeling a little bit cold, even as, like, on the merits, it's like for most other guys, you'd look at it and say, well, he's averaging like 22, 5 and 5 on 600 true shooting. That's like Hall of Famers do that. And yet for him, you're like, yeah, but like, it's supposed to be better than that, right? Because we've seen it be better than that. Like the first, you know, whatever, 20 odd games, 25 games, 30 games of last season, you're like, that's like 38-6 or whatever on 65, you know, true shit. Like that is the guy that can be the wrecking ball that absolutely destroys whatever your defensive coverage is, even in the course of a postseason series. And that is the rising tide that lifts all boats. That's the number one that allows for all those star in their role players to find their level and not be overtaxed or not, you know, be able to play a more circumscribed role in a playoff series. And that is not necessarily the Zion we have seen for most of this season. I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned he has sort of been trending up, and some of that has had to do with the move to put the ball in his hand more. Willie Green saying, you know, I'm going to lean more into point Zion. I think over the last handful of games since Dyson Daniels has been out, it's something like 7 or 8 assists a game. And, you know, like his individual shooting numbers are down, but the facilitation is way up and the turnovers are sort of steady. Do you think that's the pathway to getting, you know, finding the best version of this Pelicans team, like ball in Zion's hands, as many shooters as you can do it? Or does, you know, does that then leave you trade-offs on the other side? Like, how much, what are you giving up on the defensive end with that? You know, like, how do you think you can best maximize him to put him in position to be that number one guy that these other teams are all going to have?
100%. And I do agree that putting the ball in his hands is, at least in the short term, the path to the greatest amount of success. And them leaning into this post-All-Star break, I think, allows for enough time to rep it out by the time you get to the playoffs, right?
Right.
So, you know, you have 20-odd games or so to just really, you know, dial in and figure out the best configurations around it. Some of it is going to involve getting more of those shooters on the court. But I think the beauty with Zion has been when he's in peak form, and I put air quotes around it because I'm not sure we've seen a peak form yet, but like when he's performing to the level we've seen him in the NBA perform at, he is capable of carrying basically like ragtag units to like positive net ratings. And so what the Pelicans have found a great amount of success in is they'll just throw a bunch of athletic defenders around him that aren't necessarily offensively minded players, but Zion is just a one-man show that he can carry the offense on one end and those guys carry the defense on the other. And in those situations, Zion is also like a little bit of a gamer defensively. Like he can generate events. And so like, I think there's a strong correlation with his defensive event generation and so the kind of conditioning he's in.
Just one second. I just want to make sure event generation, meaning
generating blocks, steals, forcing opponent turnovers, just being able to play in transition because of your activity on the defensive side of the floor. And so Zion has pretty quick hands, and he's very good at swiping the ball away from players. And we've all seen him make those ridiculous highlight blocks out of nowhere. But that motor and the desire to kind of play and execute those kind of plays is correlated with his conditioning. And his conditioning has steadily improved as the season has went on. And so like CJ McCollum recently gave a it was at practice. I forget which one. He had talked about putting the ball in Zion's hands and talked about preparing him for the usage. And so what he was seeming to imply there is that there's a toll that it takes on your body to be a full-time point guard, to bring the ball up on your court, to, you know, to run the pick and roll 10 million times, to drive it. He's like averaging like 25 drives a game over the last like three or four games, which is a pretty physical and demanding play style, especially for what he's doing on those drives. And so it seems like there was an element of like, we're trying to preserve you by ramping you up to this usage. And now that it's All-Star break, you know, we're past All-Star break, let's now lean into this and see what we can do. Right.
Yeah. Like take the governors off of it and actually like, we're going to like, this is what it needs to look like in 2 months. So let's find out now.
Right. And so, you know, that's why I say like, it's been trending upwards. His minutes have been pretty much lower than any time in his career since his like rookie year, you know, prior to the All-Star break. All of his metrics that indicate usage, so like touch time, the amount of passes he's receiving, the amount of touches he's getting, the like, again, just going back to minutes, all of those indicators were down. And so, you know, you're seeing this 22-5-5 guy, as you mentioned, you're like, okay, like, you know, where's this, the guy that drops jaw-breaking stat lines? But it's been a function of the usage. And now I feel like they're finally, you know, he's getting more of those minutes. He's getting more of that usage. And so we might see some more ridiculous games from him on the back end of the season. But, you know, the other components has been like the Pelicans have blown out a lot of bad teams. And they've been on the other end of some blowouts too. And so like when there's a lot of blowouts going on, like most of those guys are not playing in the fourth quarter. And so there's been a little bit of that where like the role players, like I said, they just take over, and those bench units of the Pelicans have been so good. And it's really been like every iteration of the bench players, like, you know, the Jose Alvarado, Najee Marshall crew, they make life difficult for any opposing ball handler, right? You always got to like, you know, Jose does the Grand Theft Alvarado thing. Najee has started doing it too. And so it's like, it's kind of like caught on. And so you have to be aware of where those guys are at all times. When those guys are missing time, or like, you know, when Dyson Daniels is in the rotation, man, I think Dyson is otherworldly as a defender. Like, it's like as much like poetic as I wax about Herb Jones, like I think Dyson is like either right there and better in some aspects, right? And so he's been a handful to deal with. He's had his moments. Jordan Hawkins has had moments, and he's been in and out of the rotation. But like when he gets in, you're like, you look up, he's played 15 minutes and scored 17 points. And you're like, oh, okay, like this guy is also a handful. So they've had meaningful contributions from pretty much everyone on their roster, even their two-way guy, Matt Ryan. And it's been one of those things where the stars, the only time that they've really been pushed are these like crunch time situations, and they just haven't had the reps, and those crunch time situations have been bad for them, right? I think for the first 55 games or so, there wasn't a real hierarchy established on like what to do in those crunch time situations. I'm optimistic moving forward, the hierarchy is Zion initiates and then everything else flows off of that. So I think there's a lot that they can do, which is optimistic in terms of correcting things or improving things. And I think it's a better spot to be in as opposed to being a team that you're just know that like you just can't do. There's no more buttons to push, right? There's certain teams you're like, this is the ceiling. We found it. We've brushed up against it. We've tried to burst through it. Can't do it. Sorry. But like I think the Pelicans, they're finding out like, oh, we do have buttons to push. Can you push them consistently? Can you get better at pushing them? And so I'm hoping these next 20 games or so reveal that.
It's a little bit of a squishier thing. I don't know if that I've ever said the word squishy on this podcast. Maybe I'll never say it again because that felt weird. But what does it feel like rooting for Zion now? Like, you cover the team, but also like there was that like that moment of the you win the lottery, let's dance. Like this is a new era, and there's like the fits and starts of it, the injury issues, the noise surrounding it, you talked about the, you know, his conditioning improving over the course of the season. Obviously there's been no shortage of discussion of that over the years. Maybe reaching its pinnacle this season where, you know, Chuck and Shaq kind of, you know, I don't even think they like went after him hard, but like they noted that like this is what was on display in that semifinal game was not commensurate with the talents that he has, which then led to other commentators yelling a lot more and saying different things about it. But like it became a big conversation. And then you've got like, I imagine fans kind of like, you know, when do we get to the fireworks factory? You know, like about how this all works. So like the experience of, you know, watching and covering and rooting for and whatever, like what does that feel like now? What has that been like?
So, yeah, I think what it feels like now and what it's been like are two different things. And so what it's been like is the best way to describe it. It's been a roller coaster.
Sure.
You know, I think as you mentioned, there was that enormous amount of excitement at the draft in the preseason. He was just annihilating teams that rookie year. He is fourth or fifth game in the preseason, goes down, gets the knee injury. It's a meniscus, misses an unspecified amount of time. And actually, this is where the issue started propping up. Is they did specify the amount of time he's supposed to miss, and he missed a lot more than that, right? And so there was a lot of frustration among the fan base, but also, like, there were media members wondering, like, you guys haven't provided us any clarity or updates regarding his progress or anything like that. Like, why are people being kept in the dark? Like, at least just give us there was a setback, or, like, you know, the timelines changed, whatever it is, you know, like, just give us something rather than, like, maybe he's gonna play one day. And then
He
gets activated. He has, you know, he's put on burst minutes, 5 minutes at a time, minutes restrictions.
Oh my God, the bursts. I forgot about the bursts.
The bursts, right? Like I said, roller coaster. So people are excited to see him and he's on burst minutes. And the first game he plays is that home game against San Antonio. You know, the first three bursts he has, the first 15 minutes or so he's played are largely uneventful. Some oohs and ahs with like, oh, maybe he's going to do something. And then in the fourth quarter, just starts nailing threes. Four consecutive ones. The arena's going wild. Alvin Gentry's like, I can't bench this guy. Like, what do you want me to do? I'm trying to win a game and he's having fun. I can't bench this guy. And, you know, the medical staff is a little more powerful here. And Zion gets benched. And that becomes a source of frustration for everybody involved, right? Zion doesn't want to be benched. The fans don't want him benched. Alvin doesn't want him benched. The front office and medical staff realize that no one wants him benched, but they have to take a long-term approach and a long-term vision with this, right? So it's a source of frustration. A lot of people are butting heads over this. The world shuts down. COVID happens. They announce the bubble. And okay, cool. We start seeing social media pictures of Zion propping up in ridiculous shape, like just looking like Thor, or, you know, like just some obscenely buff dude. And we get to the bubble and he has some kind of undisclosed emergency where he has to leave the bubble very shortly. And then he leaves for about a week, comes back, has to go through the quarantine period. Somewhere in that time and the time that he gets back on the court, he's just not the guy that you see in the pictures that were on social media. He's just not in good shape. And we find out later there was an undisclosed hamstring injury that happened. And so again, more secrecy, more frustration, more, and he was in bursts when he was in the bubble too. And it was just like, what are we doing here? Right. Not much clarity. Cool. They hire Stan Van Gundy. Stan Van Gundy goes, you know what? This medical mumbo jumbo is great. He's going to play. And so he's just like right off the gate. Like that was Stan's approach. And he just throws him in the deep end. And it took Zion about a month and a half to, again, like play himself into the kind of conditioning he needs to be point Zion. And then Stan's like, here you go. Here's the ball. And that was the number one thing they discovered that season is you put the ball in his hands, you have a number one offense. And so for the 2 months before guys started going down, because then they got hit by a ton of injuries. You know, Lonzo Ball got hurt. You know, Brandon Ingram got hurt for a period. And then Zion eventually ended up getting hurt himself. But those 2 months or so where everyone was healthy, they were the best offense in the league, bar none. And so it's like, oh, this is kind of crazy. And JJ Redick was a member of that team, and they had discovered this little action with JJ screening for Zion, and that would just be a bucket every single time. Like, for one of the two people, right? It was just functionally unguardable. And you're like, okay, well, now there's a pathway. Now there's an organizational defining principle that you can build around. Okay, we're going to put the ball in his hands. Everything else will fall into place, right? Things don't go well with the Stan Van Gundy era. He gets canned after that year. they hire Willie Green, and Zion, pretty much the reports out of that summer is like ghosting and no-showing to everything, right? You're like, okay, cool. Like, all these team functions, where is he? What's going on? Is he detached? Is he aloof? And I don't know. You know, it was a tough time period to be someone covering the team, because again, you're on the hunt for information and you're not getting adequate information. And so comes out media day, everyone finds out that he has a broken foot.
Yeah.
Happened. And again, there's a timeline that is put on him and he doesn't meet the timeline and ends up missing the whole season. Very frustrating season. I think at that point, people were at their lowest on him. You know, they thought that, like, maybe, you know, he just doesn't want to be in New Orleans because he left mid-season to go to Portland away from the team to rehab. You know, maybe he just won't ever figure it out in terms of, like, getting his body right. Whatever. There was a lot of questions, right? Both on his commitment issues and his physical issues. And so the Pelicans started off awfully, but they ended up making the playoffs, and Brandon Ingram was, like, the heart and soul of the team when they did that. And so he earned a lot of goodwill amongst the fans for what he's able to accomplish, goodwill amongst the, you know, the front office, the coaching staff. And they had a competitive series against the Suns. And then Zion, you know, at the end of the year is doing this thing where he's throwing down windmill dunks, but he's not playing. And his whole thing is
the Instagram videos where it's like, is the floor bending, right?
Exactly, like, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it turns out like NBA courts by standard come with padding, and that's just like how they're built. But, you know, he does this thing and he's basically trying to say, like, I'm ready, I want to play, they won't let me. And that's kind of the angle. And the Pelicans, you know, are very adamant, like, you need to be cleared first, right?
Right.
And so I think the thing about Zion pretty consistently has been that, like, he's wanted to play against medical advice very often. He just wants to play. And so, like, the front office has had to take a slower and long-term and firm approach with him regarding that. Like, no, we're just not going to let you back on the court until you're ready to be on the court. And that's kind of been the story, and that's kind of been a source of frustration for a lot of people. And then the following year, you know, he comes back, he looks kind of like rusty to start, but then Brandon Ingram goes down, and then you see Point Zion again, and all of a sudden Pelicans are number one in the West, and Zion's doing all these things, and everyone's back on board, like, this is the guy, this is what everyone was waiting for. And then he gets hurt again, and so it's been every season a battle. Like, he shows promise, he gets hurt, the injury takes a lot longer than it needs to in terms of him, like, returning back on the court, questions arise, and then when he gets back on the court, you're like, oh, yeah, no, this is what this guy is capable of. And so it's been a struggle. I would say where I am now with him is I'm just rooting for his success. I think he's been through a lot as a person. I think he's been through a lot as a player. And I'm hoping he finds the stability that allows him to, like, actually develop and succeed. Because, like, at the end of the day, he is, like, a 23-year-old young man who has
Forget how young. Yeah.
Yeah. Who's been through the rigors of all of this national media attention that's extremely negative. Like, I just can't imagine. And I'm not saying, like, you know, athletes are not open to scrutiny. I think that does come with the job. It's just like, I'm just saying there's a human element of it where, like, if Stephen A. Smith is screaming about, like, eating tables, and, like, anytime I'm out in the public and someone snaps a picture and it ends up online, the discourse is only about if I'm fat and if I'm overweight and my body image. Like, I think that's just, like, mentally draining. Not to mention just, like, fighting back from injury for anybody is tough. Like, you know, it's just, it's tough to do, and to get back to playing at an NBA level, like, it's tough to do. And so I'm just hoping he gets the stability in his career that allows him to actually let his game do the talking rather than everything else around it do the talking.
I think I found the center of my glass onion, which is they're basically the Sixers with beignets. Like, this is it's the Joel Embiid arc, but just moved south for a while.
Yeah, I guess.
And I have had such a hard time letting go of that because I'm like, but you saw it. It was like, and like, as you mentioned, you're like number one offense, all NBA caliber player, like leads the league in holy shit moments, all of that. And then you're like, but the brass ring is like right past my grasp always. And I can't quite get it. There's so much more that I want to ask about with this, but this has been so good that I can't do it. So I'm going to say the last thing I will ask about it before we get moving is in 2 months, we'll be like in the middle of the first round of the playoffs. A couple of weeks past that, is second round of the playoffs. What do you think we're talking about the Pelicans come that time? Is it like, holy cow, Zion breakout, you know, favorite on the ropes in round two? Is it, all right, buddy, like, let's see what we can get for Brandon Ingram. You know, like, what do you think is a more likely kind of conversation that we're going to be having in that time?
I would say historically, I'm a little more pessimistic given what the Pelicans have gone through. So like,
why? I mean, I can't imagine why you would feel that way, right, given what we just talked about.
Who knows? Yeah, there's not any priors informing that. So I think I would say at this point, the most likely outcome is a first round out and people wondering what the future of the Zion Williamson, Brandon Ingram duo looks like. They're, you know, as a part of the No Cap Room podcast, I'm sure you're aware that Brandon Ingram is due for a 30% max extension this summer. And I think that's a big decision because Trey Murphy is also extension eligible this summer. They don't have to come to a deal there. But those two contracts, if you do lock them in together, will kick in at the same time that following year. And so now you're looking at being a very expensive team without necessarily being a team that has a pathway beyond the first round outside of like internal star improvement, right? Or just internal improvement. And I think that's a tricky position for this market, given their history with the luxury tax. And that's kind of going to define all of their transactions and offseason decisions, unfortunately, but that's just the reality of it. And so if it's a first round out and one or the two of them have a disappointing showing, then I think that noise is going to get very loud. Now, I'm hoping it turns out that these guys are just 16 game players and not 82 game players, right? And you know, we see Zion's ridiculous rim pressure, putting teams in all kinds of foul trouble and causing problems. BI's just incredible shot making inside the arc, like keeping the offense like at a high enough level to let their defense take over on the other end, right? And so you're hoping that carries them to a series win, and then you're competitive in the second round against a very good team that makes it out there. It's probably going to be one of those aforementioned high dollar second apron teams that's going to be there. And so then you can tell yourself, like, we didn't pay the tax this year. We were competitive against like a second apron team or someone that's blown past the tax restrictions. Then you can take that to ownership and be like, hey, if you enable the spending, then we can also do that. And so that, in my opinion, would be a great scenario for them.
Either that or you're looking at, you know, B.I. and Larry Nance Jr. is a large amount of expiring money and all the picks that are not nailed down for who can be that
free,
big swing target.
Yeah,
who shakes free, right? Well, you know, okay, I lied. If you get your druthers about that or your pie in the sky dream of who that person to shake free is, what does that look like for the Pelicans around Zion?
That's so tough because, like, for example, what if it's Giannis that shakes free, right?
Man.
So I'm just here to cause problems, right? I'm just here to cause problems. Right?
Well, now I'm concerned about inviting you on my show.
But, you know, it kind of depends on the guy, right? Because, like, if for whatever reason, like, Giannis is like, I'm tired of Doc. And, you know, I got my extension money. So I got the money. Now I can ask out. I think for first and foremost, for that caliber of player, if there is a top five caliber of guy shaking free and you even have the remote possibility of being in those discussions and you haven't ruled out because of market, then it doesn't matter who's on your roster. You just do whatever it takes to go get that person, right?
And yeah, it's a bet on yourself. Like you've got to just go get him in here, and then we figure it out from there. But,
yeah.
but you're not going to get that guy otherwise.
Right. And that may involve moving both of Zion and Brandon, right? You move Zion for one other thing and Brandon for a better fitting thing or whatever. You figure it out, right? And I'm not saying they have to do that. You figure it out. But like the second thing is like, you know, barring something like that, like it is a little bit difficult to forecast who this next like all-NBA type of guy is going to like be. And so if I'm specifically, you know, you're framing it as like building it around Zion, if I'm looking at it like from a Zion centric view and I'm trading Brandon, I think there's a couple things I'm hoping to accomplish. And if I can accomplish one of those things, that'll be a win. And so like I'm either looking for a long-term starting level center that is got the age lined up, the contract lined up, and like the talent lined up. And so, you know, I think there's a couple of those guys that might fit the bill, or I'm looking for a long-term solution at the guard spot. And or if the third thing I'd be looking for is to just get contractually younger and buy some of these
right.
Like not immediate rookie scale guys, but the tail end of like rookie scale guys who are very good. They're probably due on some money coming soon, but they're ready to contribute now. And then that way your contractual timeline has effectively been reset and you have more time to make decision on the Zion front, who's locked in. And I think, you know, his contract's quite good in terms of the outs that it has. You know, you have a lot of protection.
Yes.
On it. And you also will kind of like reset your assets a little bit to where like, okay, if there isn't an immediate star or immediate, you know, like shaker, like, you know, springing loose, then you have a good competitive team in the short term that you can have the flexibility to make moves on later when the opportunity arises. And the team I'm kind of focused on that with regards to that is Houston.
Oh, I was going to guess Cleveland, but all right. Okay, tell me Houston.
Cleveland is the team 100%, right? Cleveland, Jared Allen, Evan Mobley, I'm 100% eyeing what direction they go with those two guys. I think Garland could be a candidate for shaking free as well. And I think it's a tricky fit with CJ McCollum, but you know,
sure.
you can figure that stuff out. But you know, with regards to Houston, in terms of like the contractual reset, you know, they have Şengün, who should be a foundational piece. There's a mixed, you know, there's a mixed sense of things coming out from Houston on like how they actually view him. You have Jabari Smith Jr., you have Amen Thompson, you know, you have these guys who I think like, you know, they're not star level guys, but they're young enough. They provide you production at positions of need. You're resetting your contractual timeline. And so you can buy yourself time. And I know they're star hunting. Houston is star hunting big time. So, you know, I think that's one to look at, but yeah, Cleveland is the other for sure.
Man, may we live in interesting times. All right, before we go any further, not that we've not gone far enough, we're going to take a quick break, pay some bills, and be back on the other side with some more Divine Intervention. Welcome back to Divine Intervention, and I'm here with Shemit Dua, and we are going to wrap up with something that we call the closing five, because as I'm sure you know, Shemit, how you start is not nearly as important as how you finish. Five questions for our illustrious guest. Here we go. Question number one. Now that I've established them as the Sixers with beignets, former Warriors general manager Bob Myers recently described the Knicks as the Pelicans of the East, which by the transitive property means the Pelicans are the Knicks of the West. And maybe we found another reason I find myself so compelled by the Pelicans. Do you agree with his assessment?
I think the core of that assessment was they're a good team. They have depth. In the playoffs, it becomes about your top guys. And I, in that regard, I do agree with that assessment, right? Jalen Brunson, fantastic player. Julius Randle's been all NBA a few times now. But are you putting those guys up against Jason Tatum and Jalen Brown and Porzingis and Drew and Derek White, right? Are you putting the Pelicans guys, Brandon Ingram and Zion Williamson, against the upper echelon of the West? And look, unfortunately, at this moment, you can't confidently say that duo is better than, you know, any of the best Western duos. So, like, I think Bob Myers is right.
I mean, he's been right a lot more than he's been wrong, which makes me wonder what the hell's going to happen with the Washington football team. But fair enough. If nothing else, I feel like I can wear as a bit of a badge of honor that if the Knicks are Pelicans East and the Pelicans are Knicks West, like I feel good about those, like as an emotional attachment, like I can work with that. The Pelicans haven't made me feel nearly as badly as the Knicks have over the years. But, you know, listen, there's plenty of room in my life. There's plenty of opportunities for that to happen. The more love not that I let into my heart. It's not too late. Always make yourself vulnerable to be hurt by your basketball teams. Question number two, when you are not covering the Pelicans, make sure I have this right. You are the coach of the Tulane Tucks men ultimate frisbee team. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
All right. So this might surprise you because I'm a 41-year-old white guy who went to college, but I actually don't know anything about ultimate frisbee. Can you tell me what you like most about it and what do you like about coaching it?
Wow. So what I like most about ultimate frisbee, the sport, is that it's a fast-paced, decision-driven game, very much similar to basketball in that regard, where you have to move the ball a lot, you're moving the disc a lot, and you're real-time problem-solving to score. And so it scratches a very big competitive itch that I have. It allows me to tap into like the problem-solving aspect of things that I enjoy. And, you know, it's something where I get to like run around and there's enough of those like, holy shit, this guy's just an incredible athlete, like jaw dropping moments where you're like, I gotta respect that. And that's what makes sports fun, right? There's enough of those things going on. I'm not one of those guys personally. You know, I'm very good at what I do. That's a little humble brag, but that's not my role. You know, like
it's just not like, that humble. That's maybe just a brag. Yeah, that's all right.
It's just a brag. It's a brag. You know,
we'll allow that.
What I enjoy coaching is first and foremost just like watching the young players grow and experience the same joy that I have for the sport through their own eyes and in their own unique way. And so just like watching a player, you know, a freshman come in who's 18 and like their body's just starting to like, you know, become more than like a bag of limbs and, you know, like them figuring out like how to become coordinated functional athletes and also like, again, apply that real-time problem-solving aspect on the field and you see like that light bulb go off like, oh, okay, like now I get what I'm supposed to do. Like that's like a very rewarding feeling. And then like as a coach, again, I consider myself a competitor. There's just this aspect of like, I want to outthink the other person that I'm coaching right. against. And so like there's a great deal of satisfaction that I get from that as well.
Now I'm very fascinated. Identify for me an NBA player you would like to see play Ultimate.
And literally any single one of them.
Literally any of them?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. They would be the best. Like any NBA player would be the best athlete that Ultimate has ever seen because it's still a predominantly college. I mean, I guess it's more than college people, but it's a predominantly like, you know, like it's a predominantly privileged sport that like skews heavily like, with one demographic and it's not attracting any like real athletes. Because it just doesn't offer any kind of pathways into life. Right. So like there's not real money in it. You're not getting scholarships for it. And so like it's just not that kind of a sport yet. So but I would love to see like someone like Giannis. Oh my God. Let me just someone that's like 6'10", 7 foot, just obscenely long limbs, can jump 35 feet in the air. Just yeah. the disc is probably smaller than his hands. Like, I don't know. Like, man, I want to see what that looks like.
Giannis going deep and Jokic throwing. Like it was, oh, you know, incredible. Have him curving that sucker 75 yards down the field. That'd be a beautiful thing to see. I mean, listen, I don't particularly like AI art, but I wouldn't mind seeing a mock-up of that. all right. Question number three. What is the current status of your emotional relationship to Anthony Davis?
I feel like my status is, I would say it's healthy.
All right.
I
we don't really, get a lot of that on this show. I'll take it.
I really appreciate his game. It was disappointing the way the ending shook out during his term in New Orleans, but he was one of my favorite players to watch in New Orleans. I think they should have given him a thank you tribute video, which they never did, partly because he never also thanked the city of New Orleans. So I get it. But
yeah,
I think
way too many raw feelings on the way out the door.
Yeah, but you know, I think as an organization, like it's your job to be the bigger person. And
sure,
look, that's just my opinion on it. I would happily root for him if he were to come back to New Orleans. So I would say it's healthy.
That's a real, I mean, absolutely. Appreciate the good times. You know, don't hold on to resentments any longer than you need to. That's somebody else's luggage, man. You don't got to keep carrying it. I love that. Question number four. You were recently excited about Jordan Hawkins' answer to this question. So now I want yours. What is the biggest animal you could take in a fight with just your hands?
Oh my gosh. Oh, I'm not a very big person. So like definitely not anything big. I feel like if it would have to be something big and I'm assuming like this animal is trying to fight me and it's just not existing, right? Like
it's not just like walking past you and you're picking the fight. That would seem like a really, you know, a kind of fucked up thing to do. Like there's no exactly. reason to do that.
Yeah. You know, like I feel like giraffes are clumsy enough to where like you could
this
like,
is a terrible idea.
They're so big. Look, it is very big. It's like a high risk, like high reward play. Right.
You're a real competitor, man. I got to give you that.
This is like really fucked up because like I'm vegetarian and like I don't even like think about animals in this regard. But like, look, you put me in a life and death situation. No. But if it wasn't, you know, I feel like if you take out one of the legs, like you win. But if you can't, you're done. That's it. It's a one shot gambit. But if it wasn't that, like, I think it'd have to be something pretty small, like a raccoon or something. Like I'd be pretty scared of to fight a raccoon, to be honest, if they like started like baring their teeth and put their claws out. But like I it would definitely not be unscathed on my part, but I think I could take a raccoon.
Well, first off, I mean, all of this is incredible. I'm immediately envisioning you attacking a giraffe, like a wrestler chop blocking another one in the back of the leg to try to take him down, or like in Star Wars, like wrapping the rope around the AT-AT walkers to try to get them down. And either of those is fantastic to me. Also, yes, raccoon, extraordinarily scary. Like I have, you know, where I live in Brooklyn, we have like sort of like a trash room for the apartment building, you know, down a little courtyard. And every once in a while, you just see one of those suckers down there. And I'm like, you are too big to be in Brooklyn. Like, get away from, what are you doing here? And the answer is because we throw out, you know, tasty garbage and they like that. So, but yeah, no, I want my official answer to this question. Jordan Hawkins, I'm sure, professional athlete, strong man, much, you know, more competitive athlete than me. My issue is, no violence on the dance floor, no smoke with the animal kingdom. Let's keep it moving and, you know, go our respective ways. Question number five. This one's a two-parter, but I'll try to hold you to a quick answer on both of them. What's your least favorite thing about people coming to New Orleans for like Mardi Gras and stuff? Like, what's your least favorite thing about folks like that coming down to town? And then what is one thing you wish that they would check out that's not like Bourbon Street or whatever when they actually do that stuff?
So there's a very entitled group of people that seems to think if you show up to the parade route early enough and plant your tents and your lawn chairs and your tarps, that you're entitled to that spot. So it's like they're like colonizers. It's like the city's getting colonized in real time with their crappy lawn equipment. And you know, God forbid you end up within a 2-foot radius of their equipment and they're gonna start yelling at you about like, this is my spot. It doesn't work that way. It's you're on public streets. The city is the Mardi Gras is a collective experience for everyone. It's shared by everyone. There is no spots. There is no rule. I don't care if you got there at 1 p.m. to set up for the 6 p.m. parade. I'm going to show up at 6:25 and go where I want to go. You know, so like those I think are like some of the worst people on earth. Right? Some of them. However, if you're not one of those people and you are in New Orleans and you want to check out something cool, I think there's a few spots. If you're into the party scene, right, Frenchman Street is a more toned down version of Bourbon, and it's a lot more local oriented. There's a lot of live music. There's enough like food around. I wouldn't say like there's like high level cuisine around Frenchman as much as there is in the quarter, but there's enough good food right around. But like the vibes are impeccable. And if you want to get away from like the zoo that is the quarter at that time, like Frenchman's a good alternative. So like that would be my suggestion.
You talking about people trying to reserve spaces on public streets made me think of when I was living in Boston, and it would be like people digging out from snowstorms and then putting lawn chairs in the parking spots that they dug out. Like on one level, you dug out that spot. I get that. Like you put the work in to do that. But then I remember a lot of people getting out of their car, moving those folding chairs or whatever, and then parking their car there. And then at a certain point, it just comes down to your hands. Like, if you want that spot enough, you better be ready to fight for it. And
can you take a giraffe? Imagine... If so, take that spot.
If you can take a giraffe, take whatever goddamn spot you want.
Take that spot.
Take that spot. That's your spot. Any spot a giraffe is standing on is your spot. After the recommendation of Frenchman Street, we're going to pivot neatly into the weekly recommendation, something that we do here on Divine Intervention. Does not have to be about basketball. Past examples have included, like, Caitlin Cooper picked Outshine Popsicles. Steve Jones Jr. was talking about listening to the Andre 3000 flute record, going to the public library, taking a walk. There's been a lot of examples of things that have nothing to do with basketball, just something you think is cool and good that you would like to share with the people. So Shemit, is there something like that that you would like to share with the people?
I am strongly recommending the show on, I believe it's Paramount Plus, called Twisted Metal. So,
based on the video game of same name, correct?
Based off the video game of the same name. If you're a millennial, this is probably going to, activate like a sleeper cell within you and be like, Twisted Metal, like, let's check it out. And so it's really well done. They've done a fantastic job of building the universe around the game, building the characters out. It's lighthearted. The episodes are about 30 minutes apiece, so it's quickly digestible. There's not a lot of fluff. The plot keeps moving at a relative pace. A good amount of comedy, a good cast, in my opinion. And just I was surprised at how good it was, because I thought it was just going to be like a write-off show, like people just wanted to have a good time. And I'm like, no, I want to see more of this. It was great.
I enjoy that. Anything that's a half hour at this point, I'm a washed father of two. If it's like a half hour thing, that makes it way more likely to rise up my list, because only got so much time, you know, between putting them down, games being on, doing laundry and whatnot. You only got so much time for culture, which is why I'm an uncultured swine. And I get these recommendations from my guests. So I love that. Mine is, it's also video game related loosely. Going to a barcade. I am acknowledging that this is basic, but I am nothing if not basic. You go to a place and then there's video games and beer, and like, I don't know, man, that sounds pretty good to me. That works for how I like to do things. Over All-Star break, which was also my kids' midwinter break from school, we went and visited a friend in Pittsburgh. We went to a couple places like this, and it's like, you can go and do like duck pin bowling or some kind of thing like that, play on a giant Jenga machine, grab some beers, do some mini golf, and then like play video games, including, and this is embarrassing, but it's the truth, and I can do nothing but be embarrassed and tell the truth on my own show. I was walking with my daughter, my 9-year-old, past through the arcade, and we passed WWF WrestleFest, the arcade cabinet for WWF WrestleFest, which I don't remember when it came out, early 90s at some point. I let my daughter keep walking and dropped my coat and was like, I'm playing this. And my daughter had to come back and get me, because not for nothing, being Mr. Perfect and snapping off some perfect plexes was like one of the touchstone memories of my childhood. And so it was important to go back to that. Nostalgia is a hell of a drug. Nostalgia plus beer, even more intoxicating. If you have a local barcade, go and support it. You'll have a good time if you like things that I like. And if you've made it this far into the show, chances are you might. That is going to do it for us here on Divine Intervention. Before we get going any further, I want to make sure to recommend, if you listen to this podcast and you're a Pelicans fan and you like the way that Shemit talks, you can occasionally hear him speaking on, quote, the best inconsistent Pelicans podcast out there, In the Know, a New Orleans Pelican podcast. Anywhere else you would like to point people on your way out the door, anything else you'd like to plug?
Just the Substack is where primarily the content resides. So it's inthenow.substack.com. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter at FearTheBrown.
You should do so. You will learn more about this team that I find so compelling. That's going to do it for this episode of Divine Intervention. I want to thank again Shemit for taking all this time to be with us. And as we established, reconnecting with himself, learning and exploring. It's what we do here. Thank you so much to super producer John Gennaro for all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. If you are enjoying what you hear, give us 5 stars, rate, review, subscribe, all that kind of stuff. It helps with discoverability and growing the show on the Ball Don't Lie podcast platform. Vinnie Goodwill will be back tomorrow with another episode of The Good Word. And I will be back with Jake Fisher this Thursday on No Cap Room. I think that's about it. Thank you so much for listening, and take care of yourself. You deserve it.